Oliver Cromwell, the Protector and the English Civil War. Oliver Cromwell was one of the greatest military leaders ever. Very controversial person. There's a lot of people who hate and loathe him, and you'll see a lot of very hostile things on the internet against him too. But there's no doubt he was a very dedicated Puritan, deeply, fervently devoted to carrying out the will of God. He was relentless in battle. He was brilliant in organization. He had a genius for cavalry warfare. And with a psalm on his lips and a sword in his hand, he led his Ironsides to victory after victory, first against the Royalists in England, and then against the Catholics of Ireland, and finally against the rebellious Scots. Oliver Cromwell pursued religious toleration, which helped to stabilize the fragile country after the king was executed. His foreign policy in support of beleaguered Protestants in Europe and against the Muslim pirates, the Barbary pirates in the Mediterranean, was successful. He restored the supremacy of the seas to England. He came from a distinguished family. Oliver Cromwell was one of the very few people who could trace his family origins to the pre-Norman conquest times, back to the original Saxons. In fact, his family was to some extent related to the Stuarts, and there is the story that as a child he played with King Charles when King Charles was a prince and his father James was coming down from Scotland to take the throne after the death of Queen Elizabeth I, and Queen Elizabeth had no children, therefore her cousin, which was Mary Queen of Scots, her son James VI of Scotland became James I of England and later James I of the United Kingdom. And that's when the United Kingdom begins in the 1600s, when Scotland and England jointly have the same king. Well, as James I, the father of Charles I, came down, they stopped off at the home of the Cromwells, and young Charles would have been playing also with young Oliver Cromwell. His family was frequently active in the fight for liberty. Six of his cousins were imprisoned for refusing the forced loan of 1627. When he was first elected Member of Parliament for Huntingdon in 1628, 9 of his cousins were members of Parliament. 17 of his cousins and 9 other relatives served at one time or another as members of the Long Parliament. So a very distinguished, influential family in England. Born towards the end of Queen Elizabeth's reign, Cromwell grieved England's decline from these golden years of the Elizabethan era. His mother, his wife, and one of his daughters were all named Elizabeth, and he frequently referred to Queen Elizabeth of famous memory. England was a country in crisis. In the early 17th century, England was deeply troubled. King James I, after whom our King James Bible is a name, not that he had anything to do with it. It more should be called the William Tyndale Bible, because it's Tyndale's work that forms 90% of it. But what we know as the King James Bible, well, the King James wasn't a very good man. He wasn't a great king either. But the only good thing he ever did was allow the Bible to be translated under his realm, a new translation, mainly because he hated the Geneva Bible, which was, with its study notes and comments on the side, justified rebellion against kings and taught the principles of lex rex, that the law is king and that the king is under the law. And so he wanted to get rid of the Geneva Bible, so he allowed the King James translation, or the Authorized Bible. In England, they call it the Authorized Bible. In America, they call it the King James Bible, which is amazing because the Americans aren't monarchists. And yet the Americans love to speak about the King James Bible, whereas the British will only speak about the Authorized Version. It's the same translation, but still. Now, King James had left his realm embroiled in the conflict in Europe against Spain that launched the 30 Years' War, which was absolutely ruinous. In some ways, it was Europe's first continent-wide war. It was almost like the First World War in its devastation and its loss of life as well. And the crown was bankrupt, and England was universally disgraced because it had not the ability to even pay its debts. And so internationally, the English government was disgraced because they would not pay the debts, or could not pay the debts. James's heir, King Charles I, married a French Catholic princess less than 3 months after he inherited the throne. He is the very reason why England has a constitution that expressly forbids any heir to the British throne to marry a Catholic, or to marry a divorcee, mind you. That's all part of the 1688 Glorious Revolution, and the English Bill of Rights of 1689 puts into the laws of succession, which caused the crisis that forced King Edward VIII to abdicate when he wanted to marry an American divorcee. That was such a scandal, such a disgrace, and such a constitutional crisis. He had to abdicate the throne to be able to marry an American divorcee. Well, you can see our standards have dropped, but the laws haven't changed. And it was Charles marrying a Catholic princess who was married, came from the line of France, that caused so much chaos, like the English Civil War, that has made Britain make this law: no heir to the British throne, in other words, Prince of Wales, can ever marry a Catholic. All of England had been against this Catholic marriage, but Charles evidenced contempt for the opinions of all. He really didn't care what anyone else thinks. He was one who believed in the divine right of kings. The king can do whatever he wants. He lied. He entered into war without parliamentary approval. He made secret concessions with the Catholics, especially in Ireland. He undermined and interfered with the churches. He sent out his agents to collect forced loans. He bypassed Parliament. He sent rich people to prison until they paid the ransom he demanded. He was a wicked tyrant, a real tyrannical king. And, you know, when you've got a king wearing an earring, that's not a good sign anyway. Land confiscations multiplied under Charles, and an increasing number of men were sent to prison over refusing to hand over money to the crown. Arbitrary imprisonments, depriving men of property without any semblance of the law, jeopardized the rights of everyone in the realm, and it was in violation of the English Bill of Rights 1689 and violation of Magna Carta. James summarily dissolved Parliament whenever it interfered with his will, and he scorned a petition of rights, and he said Parliament had no rights, merely privileges granted by the Crown. The King didn't seem to consider himself to be bound by any promise nor subject to any law. That's the way James thought, and that's the way Charles, his son, thought too. In March 1629, Parliament passed a bill declaring whoever brought in innovations in religion or introduced opinions disagreeing from the true and orthodox church, whoever voluntarily paid those duties, were to be counted an enemy to the kingdom and a betrayer of its liberties. Immediately the motion was passed, the king came and dissolved Parliament, exacted a furious vengeance on Sir John Eliot, who had proposed the motion, and others who supported it. And you can see the cruelty of Charles in many different ways. Eliot and other MPs, members of Parliament, were thrown to prison. Eliot remained in prison for the rest of his life, and he died in the Tower of London in December 1632. Charles's pettiness is seen how he even refused the widow the right to take her husband's body to be buried in their Cornish home. I mean, how petty is that? Charles appointed and dismissed judges at will. He appointed Archbishop Laud, and Archbishop Laud banned the publication of Calvinist sermons, which had been collected since the time of Queen Elizabeth. Queen Elizabeth allowed the Puritans to grow, and they had much more religious liberty under Elizabeth, who was considered a bit of a tyrant, not even Charles would allow that. And, of course, under Edward VI, who was a fine, outstanding Protestant, Calvinist king, evangelistic king, lots of great Reformed sermons had been published, and now those were banned by the Archbishop of Canterbury. You might have heard of the Star Chamber. It's called the Star Chamber because of the stars in the roof. And in this hall, a secret judiciary appointed by Archbishop Laud would secretly try people without them having a right to defense. The cruelty of Archbishop Laud's Star Chamber can be seen in the treatment of a Calvinist minister, Alexander Layton, for writing a Puritan book. Layton was chained in solitary confinement until his hair fell out and his skin fell off. He was tied to a stake. He was flogged until his back was raw. He was branded in the face. That's a metal branding in the fire until you can brand him on the face. Had his nose slit, his ears cut off, and he was condemned to life imprisonment. I mean, what kind of people do this? And this is a church leader, the church leader, the Archbishop of Canterbury, personal appointee of Charles. And Archbishop Laud and Arminian waged war against Calvinism. From the moment that Laud was consecrated Archbishop of Canterbury in 1633, the Arminians assumed full control of the Church of England and declared war on Calvinism. Remember, this is all about shortly after the time of the Synod of Dort declared Arminianism to be heresy, not in accordance with the teachings of the Bible or of the Church. And therefore, you could see a sharp rift coming at that time. Well, Arminians now had control over the Church of England. Although the Church of England had been known as the Reformed Church of England in the days of King Edward VI. Now it's not called that at all. The Calvinist pastors were dismissed from their pastorates, all their parishes. The Calvinist writers and speakers were excommunicated from Church of England, placed in stocks, had their ears cut off. If you've seen the Cromwell film, which is an outstanding film, made in 1970 with enormous amount of attention to accuracy and to the history, that scene where this man who had defied the bishop comes in and his ears are cut off in the church, well, that did happen. They actually cut people's ears off for not listening to the government. Sounds like something communist terrorists would do. The treatment that Calvinists received at the hands of the Arminian Star Chamber was remarkable because the Arminians accused Calvinists of being cruel in believing that God's salvation could be selective. So because of the limited atonement, they say Calvinists worship a cruel God. But the funny thing is the Calvinists respected freedom of opinion, freedom of religion, freedom of conscience, whereas the Arminians, who believed God is cruel, they could be so cruel in opposing what they called a cruel doctrine. The Arminians had also accused the Calvinists of being in favor of a theocracy in which the church rules the state. Although that's not what a theocracy is meant to be, but that's the way it often seemed to have worked out in history. They claimed to be less ambitious, but in practice, the Arminians ruled the people through the state. They used the power of the crown to have people beheaded, burned alive, ears cut off and all that. For example, Archbishop Laud had another author, John Pym, hauled before the Star Chamber for seditious libel. Pym was barred from further practice of law. He had his university degrees rescinded. How can you do that? He was fined an impossible £5,000, which is more than most people's life income. He is pilloried, put in stocks while people threw things at him, had his ears cut off, and was then sent to prison for life. All this because of one book he had written. That's how bad it was in England under Charles. He ruled without Parliament for 11 years. All these abuses took place during the 11 years that Charles ruled England without Parliament. These 11 years were the longest years without Parliament in English history. Charles, just when they disagreed with him, he closed Parliament down for 11 years. I mean, it's bad enough that South Africa hasn't had a Parliament sitting for 2 years because of this lockdown lunacy, but imagine 11 years of this. Well, when the Scottish rebelled against the imposition of what they saw as Roman Catholic superstition ritual on their church in Scotland, Charles was forced to recall Parliament to raise new taxes and army. Now, this is intriguing because, remember, he's a Scottish king. His father's Scottish. In fact, his grandmother's Mary, Queen of Scots. So here you've got the Scottish king, but he's become so arrogant. He's imposing on the Presbyterians of Scotland an Arminian high church prayer book ritual liturgy that the Presbyterians totally reject. And he doesn't care that these are his own people. That's how arrogant he was. So the Scots have had enough and they now rebel against their own king, King Charles I. And now he's forced to recall Parliament because he needs more money. Needs over £1 million to launch a war. And this was the beginning of the Short Parliament. The Short Parliament was summoned on 13th of April, 1640. Instead of providing Charles with the money and the men to fight the Scots, they immediately started talking about the crimes of Charles's government, the atrocities of Archbishop Laud, the illegal taxation of the people, the excess of the High Commission, the terrors of the Star Chamber. And this Parliament only lasted 23 days before the King dissolved it on the 5th of May. So that's the Short Parliament. And as a result, the Commons published a remonstrance of the thousands of citizens, other freeborn people of England, on behalf of the House of Commons, and this In fact, you can see this man is behind bars because the result of writing this remonstrance was the author ended up in the Tower of London. So England under Charles was a kingdom in crisis. A whole series of crisis situations compelled Charles to call a new parliament after he had abandoned the short parliament. First of all, Muslim pirates were raiding the Irish and Cornish coasts and carrying off Christians into Islamic slavery. Between 1500 and 1800, 1.1 million European Christians, were kidnapped by Muslim pirates from North Africa who were raiding the coasts of Italy, France, Spain, Portugal, Ireland, Iceland, England, as far afield as Iceland. And Muslim Barbary pirates are coming. And you can go around the coast of England, you will see those towers. And those towers were specifically set up in the 16th century in order to have watchtowers to guard against and to give warning for when the Muslim Barbary pirates landed on the coast so people could flee inland, hopefully before they could be captured. And it's just, you know, some evidence in stone. English settlers were being slaughtered by the Catholics in Ireland. The smallest estimation is that the Catholics killed 50,000 Protestants in Ireland. That's before Oliver Cromwell went to Ireland to sort them out. I've seen statistics going up to 200,000 and even up to 500,000 Protestants slaughtered by the Catholics in Ireland in the 16th century before Oliver Cromwell's response to crush them. A Scottish army had seized northern England, York. There was general belief that a Catholic conspiracy was at work to destroy English liberties and to install an absolutist Catholic monarchy. And the fact that their king was so reluctant to defend the church, and remember, one of the titles of the King of England is Defender of the Faith. And he's married to a Catholic. She's from a French noble family. And people did not believe that Charles really was interested in protecting the Protestant faith, but he was probably beginning the groundwork to bring about the imposition of Catholicism. And Catholicism comes at that time with the Inquisition. So now the Long Parliament comes in and they seize the initiative. For 11 years, newspapers had been banned. No newspapers allowed in England. The secret circulation of pamphlets helped keep people informed, but all of these pamphlets were illegal. I mean, you could get arrested and thrown in prison for something like having some of the tracts like what we've got in our stands here at the top of the stairs. And that would be enough to get you locked up in England at that time. King Charles was being outmaneuvered and cornered. The Long Parliament moved swiftly and impeached the Earl of Strafford, the King's dictator of Ireland, as a secret papist plotting to bring his Catholic army from Ireland to alter the laws and the religion of England. So the King had brought Strafford back to deal with these rebels in Parliament, and before Strafford could move, they sought to impeach him, and they demanded death warrants on Strafford, and the King was such a spineless coward that he even signed the death warrant for his own loyal to a fault follower, the Earl of Strafford. And this is a depiction of the beheading of the Earl of Strafford outside the Tower of London. And it was obviously the biggest event in town. And the people were there with great enthusiasm because they hated Strafford. There was an even bigger turnout later when they managed to put Archbishop Laud on trial. The House of Commons also charged that the Arminian changes to the canons of the Church of England were illegal, and they impeached Laud, the Archbishop of Canterbury, of popery and treason. And here's the trial of Archbishop Laud, and he also got happily beheaded with chairs of the local people. So Laud ended up in the same tower to which he had consigned so many others, and this is a depiction, one of these illegal tracts of the people celebrating the death of Archbishop Laud, who had murdered so many innocent people. Censorship was abolished by Parliament. Pamphlets on religion and government couldn't be produced fast enough. The demand was so great, London became a fountain of Puritan publications dealing with God and government and faith and morals. The Protestant cause has always been advanced by publications on the print. As was said when I went into the Reformation Museum in Geneva, the first exhibit is of a printing press. And the sign there said, "The printing press. The reformer's friend, the tyrant's foe." And that is true. As was said by Martin Luther, that The Pope might be able to shut my mouth, but he cannot stop the printing press. The king's government collapsed. His ministers fled the country. Systematically, Parliament dismantled the instruments by which the king had oppressed the nation. No taxes could be levied without parliamentary consent. The Star Chamber and its tortures was abolished. The Privy Council was deprived of its powers. The Court of the High Commission was abolished. And the king was left financially dependent on Parliament. And Parliament also took control of the militia, the local military of each county. Oliver Cromwell played an increasingly pivotal role in Parliament, and the Long Parliament, which began its sitting in November 1640, was the fifth Parliament of Charles's reign, but it would outlive him. Cromwell had been in two previous Parliaments, which had been summarily dissolved by King Charles, so he was a veteran parliamentarian. By the way, one of my books on my shelf is To Honour God. It's on the spirituality of Oliver Cromwell, and it's based on a whole lot of his letters. And the letters he wrote to his children and the letters he wrote to military leaders and others, you can just see this man loved God, knew the scriptures, passionately concerned about people's souls, really concerned for his enemies' souls. An amazing man. Oliver Cromwell is described as having penetrating eyes of steely blue, feeling profoundly religious, well-read, eloquent, full of fervor, with an iron conviction, which his character turned into steel. He could not be moved if he believed something was right. He was a graduate of Cambridge University, a descendant of Henry VIII, Chancellor Thomas Cromwell, and dedicated Puritan. Now, if you've paid attention to the history of England back in days of Henry VIII, there was a Thomas Cromwell. Well, that was a direct ancestor of his. Thomas Cromwell was a fervent Protestant who is the one who dismantled the monasteries, stripped them of their power, destroyed the papal power in England, even while his king was a dedicated Catholic. He managed to, by brilliant politics, convince the king that his biggest enemy was Catholicism, even though the king remained a Catholic, but he just wanted to be independent of the Pope and independent of Rome, but he stayed with Catholic doctrines. Well, Thomas Cromwell certainly advanced his cause, but he did it at the cost of Catholicism. He really stripped the Catholics of their powers in England. And here's an ancestor of Oliver Cromwell. In 1620, Oliver married Elizabeth Bourchier, and Cromwell proved himself an affectionate husband, deep love towards his nine children. And there was some grief. They had a young child die in childbirth. They had another child die at school in young teens. One of his sons died in the Civil War while serving in the forces. But nevertheless, he had a very strong, strong family. Imagine, nine children. When he was 28, Oliver Cromwell was elected to Parliament as a member for Huntingdon. This Parliament lasted less than 5 months before the King dissolved it. It was 11 years before the Short Parliament was summoned, and by the time the Short Parliament was summoned, 3rd of November 1640, Oliver Cromwell was nearly 42 years old. Up till this point, he had no military experience, but that was about to change. He is today considered one of the greatest military commanders in British history, if not the greatest. He never lost a battle. He is considered the father of modern British Army. In fact, even the uniform that the Coldstream Guards and the British for many years wore of the red coats, Oliver Cromwell initiated the wearing of red coats. And his logic was, don't let the enemy see you bleed. And so his men wore red coats that you couldn't see if they were bleeding. You know, that was interesting logic. And to this day, the Queen's Guards still, Coldstream Guards will wear those red coats. That started with him. And he certainly came out of nowhere. No one could have imagined that he would become such a great commander. As war became inevitable, it seemed the king's forces had the great advantage of trained, experienced cavalry. Royalist officers were experienced at fencing and riding, and leading the king's cavalry was his cousin, Prince Rupert of the Rhine, and Prince Rupert had brought over 100 professional officers experienced in the 30 Years' War. These people had fought against Austria, against France, against Spain. I mean, these people had massive experience. The people in England had no military experience, no actual combat experience, I should say. And so Prince Rupert of the Rhine brought in an experience that should have turned the tide of the war in the king's favor. And at the first battle of Edge Hill, in fact, Rupert's cavalry just made mincemeat of the parliamentary forces, and it was more like a massacre. In the first serious battle at Edge Hill, 23rd of October 1642, the king's forces led by Prince Rupert descended upon the parliamentary infantry so effectively it was almost a massacre. But after thundering through Essex's men, the cavalry stopped to plunder the baggage, and if they hadn't done that, they could have wiped out the entire parliamentary army, but fortunately they had a chance to escape. This gave Captain Cromwell opportunity to counterattack with his cavalry and halt the royalist effort to march on London. Well, that could have been the end of the war right then. Cromwell observed to his cousin John Hampton that they will never be able to beat these gentlemen's sons schooled in sword fighting, horse riding with old decaying serving men. And it's true, a gentleman's son was brought up with martial arts. Sword fighting, horse riding, all the things that were key in battle. Whereas, what would the farmhands and so on have that could compete? So Oliver Cromwell declared he was going to find honest men who feared God and were full of the Holy Spirit. He would only accept Christians in his army. This gave Captain Cromwell an opportunity to counterattack. And what he did next in his forces, as you can see in the Cromwell film, people marching with banners like, "In God we trust and God is our strength." And he selected and trained a special force. In many ways, most books on special forces will start with Gideon's 300 and then they will be focusing on Oliver Cromwell's Ironsides. Cromwell's initiative earned him a promotion to colonel. Richard Baxter, who was an Episcopalian, he was Church of England. He was not an independent. He was not a Puritan in that sense. Well, he's a Puritan writer, but Richard Baxter was an Episcopalian. So he wasn't of Cromwell's congregational background. But he noted that Oliver Cromwell had a special care to get religious men into his troops because these were the sorts of men he esteemed and he loved. And from this happy choice flowed the avoidings of those disorders and mutinies and plunderings and grievances of the country which debased men armies are commonly accused of and guilty of. And in fact, this is true. Up till then, most armies were not paid and they were expected to live off the land and to pay themselves by loot. And this meant people were terrified when any army came into town. But it was said that never was any of Cromwell's men found to be guilty of any of the abuses of the population that were common with the king's cavaliers and with other armies. In fact, when his army was finally disbanded, they said not one was known to have gone to crime or begging or anything, that they were some of the most honest, godly men in the country. I've heard it said by some, this is probably the most God-fearing army in history. By May 1643, Cromwell had selected and trained 2,000 brave, disciplined, dedicated men, psalm-singing, as some people described them, Cromwell's psalm-singing Baptists. Well, there weren't only Baptists. There were Baptists. In fact, one of his Ironsides was none other than John Bunyan, who wrote Pilgrim's Progress and Holy War. He was one of Cromwell's selected first men. And the battles changed after that. In May 1643, Cromwell, heavily outnumbered, attacked a royalist force at Belton, killed over 100 at a cost of only 2 men. His men quickly earned a reputation of being religious, obedient, fearless, and disciplined. In October 1643, Cromwell won a victory at Winsby. And his men, known as Ironsides because that's the kind of helmets they wore, but also because they were tough. Prince Rupert led the king's forces to massacre the Calvinists at Bolton and at Clothington, and Cromwell's Ironsides were victorious at the Battle of Gainsborough on 28th of July, 1643. Oliver Cromwell stood for religious freedom ahead of anyone else of his time. Most people wanted to enforce their religion on others. He was unique. Cromwell rose in Parliament in December 1644 to propose a self-denying ordinance in which all members of the Parliament should resign their military commands. You either must be in the military or you must be in Parliament. You can't do both. Which, of course, affected him because he has a command in the army. So it basically meant he resigned his seat in Parliament at that point. He argued also for religious freedom. Presbyterians, independents, all had the same spirit of faith and prayer. They all agree here. They know no names of difference. Pity it should be otherwise anyway. All that believe have the real unity, which is most glorious, because inward and spiritual, as for being united in forms, commonly called uniformity. Every Christian will, for peace sake, study and do as far as conscience will permit. And from brethren and things of the mind, we look for no compulsion, but that of light and reason. So he said we can have an inward spiritual unity of purpose to glorify God, not outward conformity, where you've got to use this form of liturgy or this form of prayer book or wear this kind of outfit and so on and so forth. So he was against a state church. But a new threat arose. He was horrified to see that Parliament was seeking to impose Presbyterianism on the nation. Now, Baptists and Congregationalists and Anglicans and other believers had fought on the field of battle for religious freedom against Catholicism and Episcopal tyranny. Were they now to replace that with Presbyterian tyranny, he asked? Because now, Presbyterians today may be stalwarts for freedom, but at that point, they were unfortunately wanting to replace the Episcopal tyranny with their own form of Presbyterian tyranny. So much so, would you believe it, that Parliament actually passed orders that if a Baptist like John Bunyan preached, he used to be put in prison. And if he continued, after the third offense, he should be executed. I mean, can you believe it? That kind of insanity. Well, Cromwell demanded the restructuring of the army. He castigated those sections of the army where profaneness and impiety and absence of all religion, the drinking and gambling and all manner of license and laziness had led to poor performance and defeat. He says a God-fearing army will win battles. A army which dishonors God will be judged by God with defeat. And so to him, godliness came before victory on the field of battle. He argued for a new model army. Cromwell was appointed second commander of the parliamentary forces under Lord Fairfax, who was more given that position because he was a peer, the title. And he's been so eclipsed, so Oliver Cromwell, most people forget that Oliver Cromwell was for a good part of the war second command. Out of the total parliamentary force of over 88,000, Cromwell selected and trained a quarter, 22,000, as a new model army. So he started with this 2,000, now he's up to 22,000. And they knew only victory. They never were defeated. At Marsden Moor on the 2nd of July, 1644, Oliver Cromwell led his cavalry to victory of the Royalists in a most decisive battle. By now, Cromwell was a lieutenant general, and his disciplined Bible-reading, psalm-singing troops won the day. His new model army won a most decisive battle at Naseby, 14th of June, 1645. This ended the First Civil War. But now he had to face Presbyterian tyranny. Parliament was establishing Church of England as Presbyterian, with orders to persecute Baptists, Congregationalists, and other nonconformists to be imprisoned for life, and on some occasions even to be put to death if they would be incorrigible and, for example, three times violate. The only people licensed by Presbyterian synod were allowed to preach the gospel. So, you know, if you were, say, a Congregationalist or street preaching Baptist, you would get put to death in some cases. No laymen were even to be allowed to preach or expound the scriptures. And this was insane. Cromwell pioneered liberty of conscience. He was horrified. This is not what his army had fought for. He argued most passionately for religious freedom and liberty of conscience. The army did not want to see Arminian absolutism replaced with Presbyterian version of that. The independents, meaning the Congregationalists and the Baptists, no longer wanted a national church, but all varieties of the Protestant faith to be free of state interference and free of state limitations. When the Parliament sought to disband the new model army, which was overwhelmingly composed of Congregationalists, Baptists, and other independents, the Army Council sent a message to Parliament demanding liberty of conscience for its members. We have fought for this freedom. Cromwell wrote, "He that ventures his life for the liberty of his country, I wish he trust God for the liberty of his conscience, and you for the liberty he fights for." And so he demanded checks and balances. And this is why, if you go to Parliament in England, the Palace of Westminster, which includes the House of Commons and the House of Lords, there's only two statues inside the grounds. One's for King Richard I, Richard the Lionheart, whose flag is the flag of England, the Great Crusader, and the other's of Oliver Cromwell, which was erected in 1899 in the Victorian era. And there have been a lot of desires to pull this down, you can be sure. Most English people are monarchists, and there's a lot of people hostile to anyone who's had a hand in fighting the king. But Oliver Cromwell's monument stays there, and it's very prominent, and even more prominent than Richard I, because without him, effectively, there wouldn't be a parliament. The Army Council proposed a council of state, free elections, and an enlarged franchise. The right to dissent with both king and lords, no bishops, no compulsory orders of service, no compulsory obedience to Presbyterianism. And although one of the king's advisers observed, never was a crown so nearly lost, so cheaply recovered, the king contemptuously dismissed these and all the other proposals for settlement. Cromwell then became the power broker between the army, the parliament, and the captive King Charles in an attempt to restore a constitutional basis for government. However, dealing with a slippery, inflexible, dishonest Stuart monarch exhausted Cromwell's patience. And so a Second World War broke out. In 1647, Charles escaped and sought to restart the war with the Scottish Presbyterians supporting him. Now, the Scottish had started the ball rolling by wanting to fight the king. Now they're on the side of the king because the king says if he gets back to power, he'll enforce Presbyterianism on the whole country. Defeating the royalist Welch and the Scottish rebels in 1648, Cromwell supported a trial for treason of the king, which ended in the execution of Charles, 30th of January, 1649. On the 17th of August, 1648, Cromwell achieved a tremendous victory at Preston. He quickly broke up the royalist army, seized 10,000 prisoners. As on every other occasion, Cromwell was always careful to give all the glory to God. He wrote, "It pleased God to enable us to give them a defeat." No bragging. On the 6th of August, 1647, the army, 18,000 strong, with the king in their midst, entered London. And despite the illusions of the Presbyterians in Parliament, the army knew that it itself had defeated the king. Parliament hadn't defeated the king. The Independents and the Congregationalists, the Baptists, they had defeated the king. And the Presbyterians in Parliament can make whatever resolutions they like, but the army was not going to give up their liberties that they had fought for. The army included officers and men who had previously been excluded from the religious and political consensus. They were determined not to have Parliament send them back to the pattern of the past that they had so successfully fought against. They wanted independent congregations and a qualified franchise. Cromwell emerged as the leader of the independents. He was not a Presbyterian. He wasn't congregationalist. He was an independent. He believed that every congregation should rule itself and there should be no bishops over all and so on. So he favored freedom of religion for all Protestants. Notice he was not for equality of religion. He wasn't speaking about freedom of religion for Catholicism or Islam or atheism. He was speaking about for all Bible-believing Christians. John Milton, the same Milton who wrote Paradise Lost, Paradise Restored, and Henry Ireton, who, by the way, became Oliver Cromwell's son-in-law, married Bridget, his oldest daughter, and Oliver Cromwell were the ones who argued for rule by the virtuous, selected by men of standing. They did not believe in democracy. They did not believe in every person who breathes having the vote. They believed rule by the virtuous. People who have shown their commitment to society, not transients, not people who just passing through, but those who committed, homeowners and ratepayers, those who are either through education or through property ownership were qualified. And it didn't have to be a lot, but you had to own property of at least £200 to be able to vote, according to their franchise. So they rejected a universal franchise, which the Levellers proposed. Now, the Levellers were sort of like your radical communists of today. They wanted nobody being above anyone else. Everyone had to be exactly the same result. It was not pulling everyone up, it's pulling everyone down to the lowest common denominator. So the Levellers were the most radical revolutionaries of the time. And he rejected that. And he said, you can't have a man with no more fixed property than what he carries about without him voting on what to do with other people's property. And one is here today and gone tomorrow. You can't enable him by numbers to just enact confiscatory laws and take what other people through generations have built up. Therefore, he advocated a qualified franchise based upon ownership of property. I might say that was Ian Smith's view in Rhodesia. He had a qualified franchise where if you owned property, or if you had an education level of at least a matric, you could vote. So it was not a racial franchise, it was a qualified franchise in Rhodesia, and Ian Smith was motivated, amongst others, with the example of Oliver Cromwell. I know that because of discussions with him. But the king just represented treachery and duplicity. While Parliament was arguing over the form of their future faith and freedoms, King Charles was negotiating with the Scots, promising to accept and impose Presbyterianism over England and suppressing all nonconformists. The Scots, who had launched the war against Charles in the first place back in 1640, now decided it was God's will that Presbyterianism should be enforced over England through restoring Charles to the throne. They start off by objecting, how can you interfere with our religious freedom in Scotland? And now they're happy to interfere in the religious freedom of England and Wales. On the 3rd of May 1648, the Scots issued a manifesto calling on all England to accept their covenant and suppress all religious dissent from Presbyterianism, which is just insane. They also demand that the new model army be disbanded, which in the face of a military threat is the last thing you want to do. The royalist cavaliers, both from within and outside of England, hurried to join the Scots in this new conflict against parliamentary forces. And this second civil war saw the Presbyterians allied with the Arminians against the independents and the new model army. Absolutely outrageous. How these two theological opposites expected to settle their differences with one another if they ever defeated the new model army was a question no one dared ask, let alone attempt to answer at that time. There's no way they could have worked together. It's impossible. And Cromwell led part of the army to Wales, where he laid siege to Pembroke Castle. Pembroke Castle was a nearly impregnable stronghold that took an agonizing 6 weeks to subdue, a shadow of what it was then. Cromwell then had to force march his army across the country to intersect the invading Scottish army. In a ferocious three-day battle, he defeated the Scots. Now the army was outraged that the duplicity and the treachery of the king had led to a new war, even against their previous allies, the Scots. So the army demanded a trial of this man of blood. Cromwell wrote to his cousin Robin Habbond, who was guarding the king on the Isle of Wight, "I profess to thee a desire from my heart. I've prayed for it. I've waited for the day to see the union and right understanding between the godly people, Scots, English, Jews, Gentiles, Presbyterians, Independents, Baptists, and all." And they had to place the king on trial. 135 men were nominated to the High Court of Justice. The trial of the king began the 8th of January, 1648. The trial was held in the ancient Westminster Palace, which had originally been built in the time of Norman William Rufus. It was very old. And this is where the Westminster Assembly met and where the Westminster Catechism and Confession come from. In this hall, Sir Thomas More, Guy Fawkes, and Earl of Strafford had been tried. And by the way, when the Pope visited England some time back, I'm talking about Pope John Paul, he had a meeting in this very hall because of its significance. And the fact that the English Parliament could have allowed that is just outrageous. And so the goal was to convict Charles of treason. First time in history, a king was put on trial. This indictment against King read that he had, by wicked design, erected and upheld in himself an unlimited and tyrannical power to overthrow the rights and liberties of the common people. He had been given power to rule in accordance with Magna Carta. He did not have the right to usurp powers that were not expressly delegated to him and permitted in accordance with Magna Carta. You couldn't become a monarch of England without swearing to uphold Magna Carta and to govern in accordance with the laws of God and the gospels of our Lord Jesus Christ to the honor of God. And that's part of the coronation oath to this day. That he had traitorously and maliciously levied war against the present Parliament and the people. That he was a tyrant, a traitor, a murderer, and a public and impeccable enemy to the Commonwealth of England. Evidence was brought forward of illegal taxes, arbitrary imprisonments, mutilations, tortures, executions of people whose only crime had been to disagree with the king on matters of faith and ethics, and that he had trampled upon the common law of England, the chartered rights guaranteed by Magna Carta, the Great Charter of 1215. The prosecutor argued that there is a contract and a bargain made between the king and his people. A bond of protection is due from the sovereign. The other is the bond of subjection that's due from the subject. If this bond is ever broken, farewell sovereignty. Just as you owe allegiance to your king owes allegiance to the King of Kings. If he's in rebellion to the King of Kings, you mustn't join his rebellion against God. The king owes you protection. You owe him respect, taxes, and so on. If he doesn't protect you, well, the contract's broken. The authority of a ruler is valid only so long as he can provide protection in return. But the king had made war against his own subjects. There's a lot of governments in the world you could say that to. Despite Charles's attempt to disrupt and derail the proceedings, the death warrant was signed by 59 of the commissioners. And here's the document, a facsimile of it, with the seals and signatures of those brave 59 people, including, of course, Oliver Cromwell, Henry Ireton, and others. Cromwell described the execution of Charles on the 30th of January 1649 as a cruel necessity. Nobody wanted his blood. If he would have just agreed to the terms, which was not that difficult, you know, that Parliament would rule, he could be king, but it would be a constitutional monarchy. I mean, how difficult is that? And I think everyone felt sickened by the sight. They said there was such a groan that went through the crowd at the sound of the axe meeting his neck. And nobody was rejoicing as such, even though he had caused so much suffering. People realized this is serious and this is going to have serious consequences. But the shockwaves that went through Europe, for the first time in the history of the world, a king was put on trial for treason and executed after due process of law. This gave force to the principle of lex rex. Not rex lex, the king is the law, but lex rex, the law is the king. The king is under the law. Well, new threats arose. When Charles II promised he would impose Presbyterianism upon the realm, the Scottish Presbyterians mobilized again to fight their Protestant brethren. So Catholic uprising in Ireland also threatened the new republic as they slaughtered Protestants, and so Parliament had to turn their attention to Ireland. The Council of State appointed Oliver Cromwell as Lord General of a new army to deal with the Catholic threat in Ireland. And knowing that he still had to deal with the Scottish threat, Cromwell determined to subdue the Irish as quickly and as finally as possible. His first action reaching Ireland was to forbid any plunder or pillage. Two men were hanged for disobeying that order. You only have to do that a couple of times and people get the message and there's no more plundering or disorder. At Drogheda, Cromwell's forces crushed the Catholic stronghold in a ferocious battle. Now, people often are quite upset about Drogheda. They also need to realize this actually was a stronghold for piracy and of tremendous amounts of crime syndicate operating out of it. And the laws at the time were if you resist a siege and you're given a chance to surrender, before the siege engines reach the wall, you can surrender and everyone's lives will be spared. But if you force the besieging army to storm it at great loss to the attackers, obviously, then everyone in the city will be put to the sword, which was the standard rules of law at that time. But they make a big thing these days about the fact that Cromwell had his men take that place and they killed all the defenders. He then moved to Wexford, long a sword in the thigh of English traders, also a great scent of piracy. And as the town refused to surrender after an intense 8-day siege, it was put to the sword, and Cromwell prayed that this bitterness will save much blood through the goodness of God. Now, there are many Irish people who are still very angry at him for this, but it should be noted that never had Ireland been better run than after that. And the amount of public works and infrastructure and the fairness that people got in treatment. And as I said, nobody ever got persecuted or prosecuted for preaching the gospel. But he was a hard enemy to fight, but he was a very gracious person once he is in power and tolerant. So after subduing the major strongholds of resistance in Ireland, those two places, Cromwell learned that Charles II had landed in Scotland. So he left his son-in-law, Ireton, to complete the mopping up operations in Ireland, and he returned to England. And that began the Scottish campaign, a long direction to march. Young Charles II had signed the Scots National Covenant and Solemn League of Covenants, swearing to maintain Presbyterianism in his household and in all his domains, which was worthless because he never did that, you can be sure. Charles II was crowned King of Scotland at Scone. You've heard of the Stone of Scone. the stone of Scone is the stone which was used by Jacob to rest on. They've been carrying it around ever since. And they are absolutely certain that this stone of Scone is Jacob's pillow. And that's why it sits under the throne of the queen at any coronation. Lord Fairfax, the supreme commander of the parliamentary forces, refused to lead an English army into Scotland because he was a Presbyterian. So Fairfax was relieved of command. And Oliver Cromwell was appointed supreme commander of parliamentary forces. And it was inevitable he conquered Scotland. With his usual fearful efficiency, Oliver Cromwell led 16,000 well-equipped, well-experienced, determined troops into Scotland. And despite being heavily outnumbered and trapped by superior forces, Cromwell decisively defeated the Scottish army at Dunbar, 3rd of September 1650. He seized 10,000 prisoners, soon occupied Edinburgh and Lee. And then he tried to reason with the Scottish Presbyterians. Our brethren of Scotland, are we to be dealt with as enemies because we do not agree with you on all points? Are you sure that your league with wicked and carnal men is a covenant with God? I pray you read Isaiah 28. I beseech you in the mercies of Christ, think it possible that you may be mistaken. Are you troubled that Christ is preached? Is your preaching so inclusive in your function? I mean, to be offended by Baptist and Congregationalist preaching, how can you be so narrow? He argued and reasoned for liberty of conscience and religious toleration. His persuasion was somewhat successful, as numerous covenanters chose neutrality thereafter, which was something. Cromwell's victory was a victory for the independence. On the 3rd of November 1651, a year after the battle at Dunbar, Cromwell's forces defeated another massive Scottish army at Worcester. I don't know how many people in the Cape know that our Worcester is named after that place in Scotland. Charles II's massive army of 30,000 was put to flight and scattered. It's remarkable that the Presbyterians, the Arminian Episcopals, and the Catholics cooperated together to fight the Protestant Parliament of England. Each of these three groups believed in the tradition of a single faith in a single land, and they were willing to cooperate with their most determined enemies in order to crush the independent Calvinists, the Baptists, and the Congregationalists of Parliament. Cromwell's triumph is evident even at Parliament itself in England. The victory at Worcester was to be Oliver Cromwell's last battle. He was now 52 years old. In campaign after campaign, Oliver Cromwell had triumphed over vastly superior numbers numerically. His tactics had proven themselves time and again, so much that he's still reckoned as one of the greatest military leaders ever, certainly the greatest military leader in British history. He was welcomed back to London in triumph in September 1651. He was now at the height of his power and prestige. He is Captain General of the Army. He's a member of the Council of State. Oliver Cromwell's position in England was unassailable. The English royalists had been bled white. They'd been decisively defeated time and again. Charles I had been executed, Charles II now to flee to France. The Second Civil War had ended. England was firmly under control of the parliamentary forces. Ireland was subdued and would be for the next 300 years. Scotland had been conquered. The three kingdoms of England, Ireland, and Scotland were united under parliamentary government in London. But now there were battles within Parliament. The situation that confronted Oliver Cromwell upon his return to London was most disturbing. In his absence, England had declared war on Protestant Holland. And this was the first war in English history that was fought primarily for economic reasons. And this is why the first Fort of Good Hope was constructed, and then the Castle of Good Hope, because England was at war with Netherlands and they were afraid the English might come and seize the Cape. And so that's the very reason why the castle was specifically built as it was, to protect the Cape against English coming here. But fortunately, Oliver Cromwell, horrified that the English Republic should wage war against fellow Protestants, he stopped that war very quickly. He'd appreciate the Licensing Act and the Treason Acts, which overrode customary liberties. The war with Holland was resented by the new model army. The soldiers want to know, where were the reforms that they had fought for? And when Parliament refused to renew the commission for the propagation of the gospel in Wales, the army's favourite instrument for evangelising that very unstable country, it created a storm. Oliver Cromwell was outraged. This, we apprehended, would have been throwing away the liberties of the nation into the hands of those who never fought for it. I mean, not the first time people say, the politicians are giving away the country that we've fought for. You know, we won the battles and you politicians give away the war in the country. I've heard that said on a number of occasions. I've said it to some parliamentarians myself. As parliamentary intolerance and interference in a religious liberty of independence increased, Oliver Cromwell gathered some soldiers and, accompanied by Major General Thomas Harrison, he entered Parliament, sat down and listened to the discussions. At length he rose and calmly began to speak on the concern that Parliament had become a self-perpetuating oligarchy. Interesting, according to Wikipedia, an oligarchy can only take place in Russia. But, you know, as though we don't have any rich businessmen in the West to exercise undue political influence. And he said they're self-perpetuating oligarchy, unfit to govern England. He condemned the members of Parliament as drunkards and whoremasters. And he ended the long Parliament. You are no Parliament, I say, you are no Parliament. I'll put an end to your sitting. He turned to Harrison and ordered, call him in, call him in. Soldiers appeared. Oliver Cromwell told him to clear the room. In fact, some years before, when they had been voting to postpone elections yet again, I mean, they hadn't gone to the electorate in 11 years, he whispered to one of his friends, he said, these men will only leave when they are dragged out by the army. And in fact, that's what happened. The members left some of the protest, but this ended the long Parliament that had dethroned a king, abolished the House of Lords, created a new government, won a revolution, only to get itself abolished. That's the thing. You start a war, you never know how it's going to end. Those who take up the sword will perish by the sword. Cromwell called for a new Parliament of 140 members. Some were chosen by churches, others by various generals. Some, five were from Scotland, six were from Ireland. London Puritans predominated naturally because they had the least distance to travel. In short order, this Parliament reviewed the judicial system, voted to abolish the office of the Court of Chancery. Tenants would provide protection against arbitrary expulsions by the landlords. For the first time in English history, marriages were made possible by civil ceremony. They saw no reason why the church should dominate in marriage. Their proposals not to execute pickpockets and horse thieves for first offences shocked the lawyers. England had, in the days of Charles Dickens, 300 offences that had the death penalty. And you just have to read Dickens' books like Oliver Twist to get an idea of just how harsh things were, Great Expectations. And so many of these laws were reformed, and a lot of these reforms are very constructive. But they alienated the population by seeking to abolish tithes. The point is, why should the state be collecting tithes for the churches? Let the church have their own offerings, but it's at a state church. You have this even today in some countries, like Germany, where the state takes your tithe with the taxes and then they pay the minister of the church, which means the churches are run by people appointed and answerable and paid for by the state, which is unhealthy. And it was like that in England at that time. Concerned that Parliament was seeking to undermine the church, meaning the Episcopal Church, Anglican Church, to secure ownership of property, the army grew impatient and persuaded members to voluntarily dissolve. And they needed a new constitution. Interestingly, Oliver Cromwell's government ran by constitution. England's not famous for constitutions, but they had it. It was called the Instrument of Government. 16th of December, 1653, Oliver Cromwell was proclaimed Lord Protector of the Commonwealth of England, Scotland, and Ireland. Elected position, not for life, not hereditary. He was the third Lord Protector of England. This isn't a new title. Back in the 1400s, there was a Lord Protector of England to protect one of the youngsters who had taken over the throne. Here's the correct heir, but until he came to his majority, there was a Lord Protector. And similarly, when Edward VI, the evangelical Calvinist son of Henry VIII, became King of England, he was only 9 years old. So there was a Lord Protector of England who was very highly respected. And he did a wonderful work of reformation because he is such a dedicated Christian. So the term Lord Protector did pre-exist Oliver Cromwell, and he's certainly the most famous Lord Protector. And he is to be the chief executive, assisted by a council of 15 members, 8 civilians, 7 army officers. Parliament was to retain the power alone to levy taxes, to grant supply to government, but the Protector could not dissolve Parliament while it was in session, and Parliament had to have regular elections. You'd think that's pretty basic, but And then the religious freedom that Ironsides like John Bunyan had fought for. Oliver Cromwell believed in an established, non-Episcopal, evangelical church with full toleration of dissent and separate congregations. So he believed the Church of England should be the way it manifests in any congregation. You know, you could have a Baptist congregation as part of the Church of England, you can have an Episcopal, you can have a Presbyterian, you can have all kinds of independent congregations, and they're all part of the Church of England. There's no bishop, there's no archbishop, government has no say over it, you're part of the Church of England if you've got a Bible-believing church in England, and it's all run by the local congregation. That was his view. And this was fully supported by the Baptists and the Congregationalists, obviously. The new government was silent on rites, ceremonies, and sacraments. That's up to local congregation. How to administer the Lord's Supper or baptism left to each congregation. Church government was to be congregational, allowing for Presbyterian, independent, Baptist, Episcopal congregation, any form of Protestant worship was permitted. This was unprecedented and revolutionary in the world. Nowhere in the world had you seen such tolerance before. Under Oliver Cromwell's rule, the arts flourished. I mean, anyone heard of John Milton, John Owen, the writings of the Puritans and so on. Writers found the protection under Oliver Cromwell was far more lenient than his bureaucratic predecessors. Literature flourished. The Calvinist love of poetry appeared everywhere. Christmas again became festive. Musical entertainments and theatre, which had been prohibited under the Presbyterian Parliament, was encouraged under Puritan protection. Many people blame Oliver Cromwell for abolishing Christmas. Actually, he didn't abolish Christmas. He was in Ireland at the time fighting the Catholics. Parliament abolished Christmas, and that was the Presbyterians chose to abolish it. He didn't think that this was something that Parliament should get involved in. It's none of their business. They shouldn't promote it. They shouldn't ban it. So he brought Christmas back. So the accusation that he was the Grinch who stole Christmas is not true. The first full-length five-act English opera, The Siege of Rhodes, premiered under the Protector. Women were again allowed to wear makeup. You could have got locked up for that before, under the Presbyterians. Even play readings, which satirized the government, were allowed. That during the Commonwealth, the violin became popular, that solo singing began to be enjoyed. And by the way, the first woman ever to appear on the stage in England appeared under the protectorate of Oliver Cromwell, because women were never allowed to act on the stage. Man had to play a woman's role, but under him it was allowed. So how many people tell you that? It's always that he's so intolerant, but in fact he was very tolerant. His foreign policy was particularly good. He promptly made peace with Holland, instantly. The British Navy crossed the oceans, restored Virginia and Barbados Islands to England. In the summer of 1654, the Lord Protector summoned the Spanish ambassador, told him the Englishmen in Spanish territories should have liberty to worship as they pleased, free of the Inquisition, that English traders should no longer be molested. And his navy was strong enough to be able to make that threat. The negative response of the ambassador prompted Cromwell to send an English fleet to San Domingo and to Jamaica, and the expedition succeeded in conquering this previously Spanish territory, which is why the people in Jamaica speak English, not Spanish. Cromwell dreamed that Calvinists from New England would settle there, unfortunately became another Barbados, a place for English, shipping the criminals and rebels, which was not his plan. But one of his greatest achievements was defeating the Barbary pirates. April 1655, Admiral Blake led the English Navy into the pirate stronghold of Tunis. North Africa destroyed the bay ships, forced the Sultan to release all English prisoners and slaves, and there were lots of them. And Oliver Cromwell sent his warm congratulations on this decisive act against the Barbary pirates. He ordered Blake to proceed to Cadiz to intercept Spanish ships carrying treasure from the New World, because they were still persecuting Protestants over there, so their ships were fair game. Defending the Waldensians are one of the greatest achievements. In May 1655, the Catholic Duke of Savoy unleashed a vicious persecution against the Protestant Huguenots in the Vaudois, or the Waldensians Valley. Newspapers in England reported a devilish crew of priests and Jesuits leading unspeakable atrocities against the Protestant brethren. Waldensians, the oldest group of Protestants in the world, have been going since the 1100s. Oliver Cromwell immediately sent an agent to the scene, and his report verified the persecution. The Lord Protector headed a subscription list that raised several hundred thousand pounds for the relief of the Waldensians. And here's his secretary. John Owen was a secretary because he spoke so many languages. Yeah, Italian, French, German, all that. And he could quickly translate Spanish, whatever. And even when John Milton was blind, he still was using him as a secretary because he was able to translate immediately and others could take down the writings. Cromwell then brought pressure to bear on the Duke of Savoy to stop the campaign. He threatened, in fact, his letter's brilliant. It's a real iron fist in a velvet glove. We'd so much like to live at peace with the people of Savoy and France. I would hate to have to send the English Navy to burn your ships and to send our new model army to fight against your people. It would be a decent and Christian thing to do to allow the Waldensians to live in peace, to excise tolls. We'd like to trade with you rather than fight you. So it was, you know, the threat was there, but it was done in a polite way. And the Waldensians survived to this day because this letter sobered them up. And the greatest book written on Oliver Cromwell, The Protector, written by Amandier, who's a Waldensian, a Huguenot, and he described Oliver Cromwell as one of the three greatest Christians in history, along with Martin Luther, John Calvin, Oliver Cromwell. That was written in the 1800s, but still, there are people around the world who would agree that Oliver Cromwell belongs in that category. And I think some of you have seen my picture of a postcard I picked up in Wittenberg, which has got eight great reformers. And there's, you know, surprisingly enough, in even the 1600s, they were putting on there someone like the line from the north, the Swedish king, Gustav Adolphus. So when you go to Geneva and you see the Reformation War, there's only one military man there, and that's Oliver Cromwell. So that is intriguing. He stood for social justice. Oliver Cromwell turned his attention to cruelty to animals. He banned cockfights and bear baits. Vagrants who were often involved in drunkenness and theft were swept up by the military, evaluated by officers, either imprisoned or sent to forced labor outside of the country. If you won't be gainfully employed, we will put you to gainful employment. And surprisingly, for a man who is the dictator of England, he gave freedom to the Jews. He invited Jews to return to England, not for the political reasons that Americans have this idolatrous worship of the Jews and the state of Israel today, but because the Bible prophesies that they will come to Christ in great numbers. And he thought, how are they to come to Christ unless they hear the preaching of the gospel? And England's now probably got the finest preaching of the gospel anywhere in the world. So let's invite the Jews to come here that they might hear the gospel and be saved. So Jews had been officially expelled from England in 1290 by order of King Richard I, for after warning them not to charge usury, and the usury continued, and a whole lot of other things. And so the Puritan Protector now launched a campaign for the return of the Jews to England. Cromwell didn't theologically approve of Jews, of course, nor did he approve of Unitarians, anybody who denied the deity of Christ, but he favored freedom of religion, and he wondered if he could extend that to the Jews as well, because he wanted to see the fulfillment of the prophecy of Jews being brought to repentance and salvation in Christ. So he hosted Manasseh ben Israel at Whitehall, which is where his officers were. This earned him a lot of opposition. It was extremely controversial, and London merchants were foreseeing a lot of fearsome competition from this close-knit network that was hard to beat. And on the 4th of December 1655, Cromwell made a speech in Parliament which smothered the objections of the council to the readmittance of Jews to England, and for better or for worse, they came in back to England dating at that time. Some think he was very ill-advised and didn't understand all the intrigues that came with them, but still, he doesn't fit the narrative of being this intolerant Puritan that people often try to make out. Cromwell was frequently burdened by the cost of war against Spain. His head of security Thurlow uncovered numerous plots to murder the Protector. Secret polices in England are normally dated back to Queen Elizabeth I, and Walsingham started the first English Secret Service to keep Queen Elizabeth alive because of all the Catholic intrigues to murder her. Well, English Secret Service really had to escalate dramatically under the time of Oliver Cromwell because there were so many plots to kill him. Now, those Jews who returned to England did flourish, and they provided some useful intelligence for England security through the international commerce network of conspiracies from the Commonwealth to the Commonwealth from Spain. At one point, they actually offered the crown to Oliver Cromwell. Cromwell refused the offers of the crown, declaring he cannot undertake this government with the title of king. "We did not cut off this king's head to steal his crown," he said. The whole of Europe was astonished, but the Calvinists hailed this decision as proof that Cromwell did not bow before the honors of this world. And he made England a refuge for the persecuted. Not only did the Protector welcome Jews to England, but Protestants of all nations. The University of Oxford received an influx of distinguished foreign Protestant professors. Education profited immensely from the Commonwealth and the Calvinists that poured in. And, of course, he waged war against Spain. Tremendous victories against Spain. In June 1658, 6,000 English soldiers defeated the Spanish in Mardyke, Gravelines, and Dunkirk. And this finalized the freedom of the Protestants in Holland from what had previously been the Spanish Netherlands. So, of course, this affected the Cape too, that finally the Netherlands was free of Spain and was able to grow to be a great power. And he restored the House of Lords, which Parliament had earlier abolished. Oliver Cromwell restored the House of Lords, declaring, "Unless you have such a thing as balance, we cannot be safe." He recognized Parliament on its own can be oppressive. And if you want to know why there's an upper house and lower house in America, South Africa, Australia, New Zealand, it's because of this experiment of Oliver Cromwell's. And under the Protectorate, the Westminster Confession, the Westminster Standards, the Westminster Catechism all produced, considered some of the finest declarations ever of what the Christian faith is. But Cromwell's religious toleration even led to having talks with George Fox of the Quakers. And when a well-known Quaker preacher, James Naylor, rode in triumph into Bristol on a donkey to cries of Hosanna from his hysterical supporters, who changed Naylor's name to Jesus, the parliamentary authorities arrested Naylor for blasphemy, obviously, sent him to whipping, branding, and life imprisonments, and Cromwell was appalled. He sought to alleviate the sentence because, while you don't want to tolerate blasphemy, he thought this is just going too far. But he's informed by Parliament that he could not interfere with this. I mean, the people are just too outraged. So tolerance had its limits. Oliver Cromwell's frequently been blamed for the excesses of the Commonwealth Parliament. But many of these extremes, like banning Christmas and closing down the theatres, was done by the Presbyterian Parliament, rescinded by the Puritan Protector when he came to power. One of the most significant things he did in Europe was the Protestant Alliance. Cromwell sought to build up a Protestant league throughout Northern Europe. He settled disputes between Denmark and Sweden, concluded an alliance with Sweden, restored the supremacy of the seas to England, and challenged the Catholic powers and Muslim pirates in the Mediterranean Sea, which was pretty impressive. During the time of Oliver Cromwell, England was feared and respected throughout Europe. Cromwell formed a strong alliance with Holland and England. He negotiated peace between Protestant nations. He cleared the English Channel and the Mediterranean Sea of pirates, all for the good of everyone concerned. He expanded foreign trade. He worked enthusiastically for the evangelization of Indians in North America. The first English mission organization that we can discern is the one set up by Oliver Cromwell for the evangelization of Indians, because Indians in North America were pagans under English control. And so he saw the moral obligation to evangelize them. And he put a lot of money into that. During the time of Oliver Cromwell's protectorate, the whole world learned to respect British sea power, which is still significant to this day. Cromwell became known as the champion of Protestantism, the arbitrator of Europe, a patron of learning and of the arts, a tireless worker to lay legal foundations and checks and balances for the parliamentary rule of England, which is why when you go to the Geneva Wall or the Reformation Wall in Geneva, you see Oliver Cromwell. One man is holding a sword. Of the 10 people there, there are 3 on each side, there's 4 in the middle, the theologians are in the middle, and there's Oliver Cromwell holding his sword, quite obviously the military man, and under post tenebris lux, after darkness light. Oliver Cromwell is reckoned as one of the most significant reformers in history at the Reformation Monument in Geneva. Very extraordinary and quite powerful. This was the banner of Oliver Cromwell as Lord Protector of England. What do you see? The flag of England, flag of Scotland, the flag of Ireland, the harp, and the royal lion. And this is the crest of Parliament that you had in the middle of Parliament, and this was the national crest under the Protectorate of England. As always, you've got the Lion of England, or the Lion of Scotland too, and you've got the Dragon of Wales. So, peace decided through strength in battle. And so, his title was the Protector. While some have sought to describe Oliver Cromwell as a dictator, there was never an attempt to make any kind of party around the personality of the Protector. Respect was always shown for private property, and effective vocal opposition was always tolerated. When he went to Edinburgh, he went and attended Presbyterian church services, and he heard the Presbyterian preachers rail against the English and against him personally and his army. He never had any minister arrested or detained or silenced for any preaching. He tolerated the press publishing all kinds of attacks on him. He really was tolerant. Very few people put to death under the Protectorate. None for political crimes. No one was cast into prison without a trial. So if he was a dictator, what does that make Charles I, who had people locked up for all sorts of things? And that's why this heritage of freedom is celebrated even in the precincts of the Parliament of England, although there's been many attempts to try and remove it, you can be sure. Liberty of conscience and freedom of the press flourished under Oliver Cromwell. Religious toleration reached new heights, unprecedented up till that time. It's remarkable that in a time of bitter conflict, Oliver Cromwell could write, "We look for no compulsion but that of light and reason." He pioneered a new model army, the first professional army in the history of the world. He created the world's first global sea power. He laid the foundation for the Industrial Revolution, the British Empire. He preserved the common law. Otto Scott, in The Great Christian Revolution, which is, to me, the best book you can read on the English Civil War and Oliver Cromwell, Luther and Knox and Cromwell and Calvin lifted millions from the swamps in which they were placed by elegant men in power. He noted that the foundational work of Oliver Cromwell in establishing checks and balances for the rule of law triumphed in the United States of America, as people inspired by his example instituted many of the same principles of government and restrictions and power in their nation as Cromwell had worked so hard to achieve in England. He pointed out, who were the people who built up the United States? People who went to America under the time of the Protectorate. Washington, Lee, Jackson, so many great names, Madison, Jefferson. These, their grandparents immigrated to America in the 1600s, and their grandchildren were the ones who formed the American Constitution, so on, using the checks and balances system that Oliver Cromwell had experimented with and realized you need an upper house, you need a lower house, you need a separate judiciary, or written constitution, all these things that he tried in England with some success were finally implemented in the United States. And so Otto Scott writes, our War of Independence raised men like Cromwell's, who fought like Cromwell's for the same reason that Cromwell fought. The men at Philadelphia echoed the history of the 1640s and 1650s when they wrote the Constitution with its limitations on the powers of Congress, the presidency and the court, when they said in the Constitution that this nation would not have established church that reflected the experience of their forebearers with the Lord and his successors. And so when people come out with, you know, the American Constitution was the first constitutionist, no, it was based on Cromwell's Constitution and the Institutes of Government. It was based on Magna Carta and the English Bill of Rights, 1689. You know, this idea that everything started in America, like the oldest republic in the world. You never heard of Switzerland? 1890, been up there for literally 700 years. Otto Scott writes about Oliver Cromwell's experiments in England is what enabled the United States of America to work. That was what laid the foundation. Yeah, remember, America was founded, that's what they celebrated on the 4th of July, by homeschooling fathers with guns. the very people that today they loathe. When they spoke about open doors to all, open careers for all, they spoke in accents of Cromwell and the Calvinists, the Independents and the Congregationalists, and the Puritans and the Presbyterians and the Levellers, and all those who fought under those banners. All this and more came from the great Christian Revolution. All the liberties that men know have come from Christianity, from its lessons about the individual and the state, God and the covenant, to fulfill God's word by bringing justice, truth, faith, and joy to the world. It should also be mentioned that he had a vision for world missions. Under Oliver Cromwell, the Society for the Propagation of the Gospel in New England was established. An enormous sum of money was donated towards his first evangelical missionary society. Cromwell was keenly interested in the evangelization of the Red Indians. He proposed a comprehensive plan for world evangelization. He divided the world up into four great mission fields. But unfortunately, the death of Oliver Cromwell and a restoration of the monarchy in England under the wicked Charles II set back the cause of missionaries. He's described as the chief of men. John Milton wrote, "Cromwell, a chief of men, who through a cloud, not of war only, but distractions rude, guided by faith and matchless fortitude, to peace and truth the glorious way has ploughed, and on the neck of crowned fortune proud, hath reared God's trophies and his work pursued, where Darwin's stream with blood of Scots imbued, and Dunbar field resounds thy praise loud, and Vista's laureate wreath. Yet much remains to conquer still, peace hath her victories. No less renowned than war, new foes arise, threatening to bind our souls with secular chains. Help us to save the conscience from the paw of hireling wolves, whose gospel is their gnaw." I went to Milton Junior and Milton High School in Rhodesia, named after this great man. Certainly one of the greatest English leaders of all time. President Theodore Roosevelt wrote a biography on Oliver Cromwell. He described him as the greatest Englishman of the 17th century, the greatest soldier statesman of the 17th century, whose sacrifice and achievements has produced the English-speaking world as we know it today. That's not an exaggeration. The idea of constitutional monarchies and the rule of law is now pretty well established, but it was not at that time. Theodore Roosevelt makes comparisons with the Confederate General Stonewall Jackson and Oliver Cromwell and the American War of Independence with the English Civil War, and there are comparisons to that. Theodore Roosevelt concluded that, in his opinion, Oliver Cromwell was one of the greatest of all Englishmen and by far the greatest ruler of England itself. A man who, in times that tried men's souls, dealt with vast questions and solved tremendous problems. A man who erred, but who strove mightily towards the light as it was given him to see the light. A man who had the welfare of his countrymen and the greatness of his country very close to his heart, who sought to make the great laws of righteousness living forces in the governments of the world. Well, these are some of my sources, but I would highly recommend The Great Christian Revolution, which is superb, and The Protector by de Aubigné, who's a Huguenot. I've actually got Oliver Cromwell's letters and speeches, edited by Thomas Carlyle, printed in the 1840s. I've got original first edition copies of that too. We've got a lot of this in our library as well. One of our great soldiers for Christ. Any questions, any comments? Of course, there's a chapter on him in Victorious Christians Who Changed the World. Questions, comments on Oliver Cromwell? If you get a chance to see this film, one of the great films, one of the best films ever produced in England, Richard Harris and Alec Guinness and Cromwell, 1970. I remember it made a great impact on me as a youngster seeing this. I wasn't a Christian, wasn't brought up in a Christian home, but never forgot the power and the message of this, and of conviction, of standing up for what's right, and the duplicity of backstabbing politicians. They don't make films like this anymore. Well worth seeing. So, any questions, comments?
When I researched him, just to see like what does maybe like the world say he is, and it said Oliver Cromwell, the man who killed the king.
Yes. It is to be noted that if you If you want to know what the world thinks, you go to Wikipedia or the Encyclopedia Britannica. The encyclopedias were first started by anti-Christian forces funded by the banks to give an anti-Christian secular perspective on the world. That's the history of encyclopedias. And Wikipedia is the most aggressively anti-Christian globalist force out there. So if we want to know what our enemies think, we turn to encyclopedias and Wikipedia. But they will not give us the truth. Well, no, he didn't personally kill the king, but he was part of the parliament that brought the king to trial. The king didn't give the right of trial to many of his victims. And so he was part of the parliament. Now, to show you how petty King Charles II was, when King Charles, now, after the death of Oliver Cromwell, his son Richard was elected Lord Protector, and he didn't do a very good job, and in a very short while handed back to King Charles II, who came back. And King Charles II tracked down every single person who had signed the warrant of death warrant on the king, the 59 justices, had those who were still alive tortured to death, took the body, disinterred the body of Oliver Cromwell and his son-in-law and his daughter, Bridget, had them hung out for 10 years until, from Tower of London, not Tower of London, London Bridge, to till they'd fallen to pieces and so on, in public display. But the amount of petty, nasty, vicious things done, even to his daughter. His daughter died, but dug up her body and public display and all this. This kind of absolute meanness that you can just see the royalists were low and savage, just no standards at all. And of course Hollywood loves people like Charles II because he was a very immoral man. Yeah, they called him Merry King, but I mean, oh, it's absolutely ghastly. And and that's why Milton wrote the book Paradise Lost and Paradise Regained. And while he's taken from the Bible, the obvious themes of we had paradise in England for a while and we lost it. And he drew a comparison between the original Paradise Lost and then a vision of victory of the Paradise Regained in the future. But England went into such a downturn when Charles II came to power. And that's when John Bunyan was thrown into prison for preaching the gospel because he was a Baptist and he wasn't an Episcopalian. And that's why we've got books like Pilgrim's Progress. And Fox's Book of Martyrs also came out to expose these people.
And Peter, where were the Anabaptists in this whole 17th century? What did they think of his...
Well, the Anabaptists were around already from the 1500s. So they would have been around. But there weren't too many Anabaptists in England. Most Anabaptists were in the Netherlands and Germany and Switzerland. Britain had Baptists, but not Anabaptists. I mean, there's a big difference. The Anabaptists were much more revolutionary. I mean, they believed in being rebaptized, whereas the Baptists were holding to that you need to be baptized once, not rebaptized. So, and of course, by immersion on confession of your faith. But the Anabaptists were pretty revolutionary. They started out as very violent, but the later generations of Anabaptists became totally pacifist, which is what they are now. Yes?
I just noticed that movie won an Oscar.
Yes. 1970 was a very different time.
Yes.
But the quality of the film is just extraordinary. I mean, everything, the battle scenes, the parliamentary scenes, but the depth, there's a few things in it that you wonder, where did this come from? They've got one phrase where they put in Oliver Cromwell's mouth where he speaks of democracy, which is the only way he'd have mentioned democracy was to condemn it, because he was not a Democrat. He believed in the rule of law, and he believed in elections, but he didn't believe in just anyone being able to vote. He believed in a qualified franchise, so his standards were there. But for him, you know, to use a word like democracy, I think, how could that have gotten in? Because there's so much of the film that's so accurate and so true from, you can see from the clothing, everything. They've even many of the words and speeches are exactly from the history. But that one on democracy, it's like, I don't know why that got slid in. So no film is ever totally accurate, but I must say, I think this is one that's like 90-something percent really outstanding. One of my all-time favorite films.
Is it also a Hollywood production?
No, it's not Hollywood. It was made in England. It's an English film. When England still made good films. That's going back a long way.
Did Parliament completely cave to Charles II? After all the laws.
No. Charles II didn't have full power. I mean, he tried, but in fact, Charles II had to walk a tightrope. He was allowed to carry out his vengeance on the 59 who had signed the death certificate, but he basically had to leave everyone else alone. But he still was enforcing Catholicism, so much for a solemn league and covenant with the Presbyterians. He still enforced Catholicism to such, sorry, Episcopalianism to such an extent that Baptists like John Bunyan ended up in Bedford Prison. But his son, James II, was an open papist. And that's when Parliament called in the William and Mary. Now, Mary was a Stuart. She's the last of the Stuarts, but she is Protestant. And she is married to a Huguenot Prince of Netherlands, and they came in, William and Mary, in the Glorious Revolution of 1688, and the English Bill of Rights 1689, and from that point, I mean, the Stuart line was eradicated, and that was the end of the Catholic attempt, and that's when they brought in such strong principles, such as that no ruler of England, no king or queen can ever be Catholic, married to Catholic, or be married to a divorcee. Or be divorced themselves, which I'd like to see how on earth they're going to get past that. If they want to make Charles and Camilla the next monarchs of England, how do they get past that? Because it's been so clear that that's what forbade Edward VIII from coming to crown, just marrying a divorcee, who is an American. I don't know which was worse, but... But to think that they can consider Charles, who's divorced himself and married a divorcee, but worse than that, he has said he wants to change the title and his coronation oath to not be defender of the faith, but defender of faiths, which is just like, to use the English term, it's just not on. It's completely unconstitutional. So I'd say England's heading for a mega constitutional crisis if they try to make Charles king. I think they've got to go straight to William, which has happened before. They've often missed a generation, gone to the grandchildren, because sometimes there's good reason for that. And if there's ever good reason, I'd say Charles would make an awful king. Do you know, he's such an Islamist. He's fallen over himself to help the Muslims. He's no Protestant. The Queen has been consistent in her speeches of espousing Protestant principles. And in fact, the gospel comes over in her speeches. But Charles, I don't think I've heard a gospel concept from him ever. So anyway, but that's a battle for the English people to fight.
Cromwell's quite infamous for his siege and capture of that place in Ireland.
Yes, Wexton and Drogheda.
Yeah, that one. Is it true that he killed man, woman, and child afterwards? Because a lot of reports,
yes,
he killed everyone.
Yes, that is what the Catholics say. Interestingly, there's an Irish Catholic who's written a book recently on Cromwell. I think the title is something like Wrongly Accused. Oh, no, it's Honourable Enemy. The title's Honourable Enemy, and one of the subtitles is Wrongly Accused, where a Catholic Irish person reports that Cromwell has really been targeted for very unfair, unbalanced propaganda and accusations, and that, in fact, he dealt most honourably with the Irish. And while he was ruthless to the defenders, he was not to their wives and children and families. And so to suggest that his men killed everybody in the city is wrong. It was the defenders. who refused to surrender. So I don't know the exact details on that, but I do know that there's an Irish Catholic whose book's Honourable Enemy, which I haven't gotten hold of yet, really turns the tables on the popular narrative. He's not the only one. There's other Irish Catholics who've spoken up more recently to say, look, this is really unfair and, the way we've demonized Cromwell. In fact, after Cromwell, Ireland had more peace, stability, everybody. And also, what's often forgotten is the fact that the Catholics had massacred tens of thousands to possibly hundreds of thousands of Protestants before Cromwell invaded. So it's not like there wasn't some context. And those two towns were serious, serious centers for piracy and atrocity. So it wasn't like they were just minding their own business. Good. Anything else? Oliver Cromwell, English Civil War.
What are the Congregationalists?
Well, most Congregationalists are Calvinist, Reformed. In fact, you can see that with the Savoy Declaration. But you can have Congregationalists who have a variety of opinions. I mean, you could have a charismatic or an Arminian congregational church, but traditionally, a congregational church are Calvinists, but they don't believe that you should have a synod overruling your local congregation. For example, David Livingstone would be one of the most famous congregationalists of all time, and he belonged to the London Missionary Society, which is a congregationalist missionary society. So the LMS, David Livingstone, Robert Moffat, these are congregationalists just as examples. But and so Oliver Cromwell himself was a Congregationalist independent. He wasn't specifically a Baptist, although some of his best troops like John Bunyan were Baptist. So the Baptists and the Congregationalists were the backbone of the army. And they were fed up with these theologians back in London who weren't in the battlefield, but they were trying to tell them how things were going to be afterwards. So you can just understand that those soldiers must have had enough of it. And so I'm very sympathetic, obviously, to Oliver Cromwell. I think that he is absolutely tremendous. And I remember many an argument with Catholic friends of mine. Yes, they've been taught with their mother's milk to hate Oliver Cromwell. I mean, he's like the bogeyman. He's the most hated by the Catholics in general and the Irish, because he was the Puritan general, the Puritan statesman. And do you know the difference between a Puritan and a separatist? So the pilgrims who went to America were separatists. They just want to be left alone. So a pilgrim is a Calvinist or a Reformed person who wants to be left alone and to bring up their family in a separate from the world, the world's influences, just left alone. A Puritan wants to change everything, including the whole world and everything in it. So a Puritan is they want to purify worship, they want to purify everything in society to be honorable to the Lord. So they've taken the Great Commission seriously. The Lordship of Christ to all areas of life is a very Puritan term. So applying the Lordship of Christ to all areas of life, that's the sort of thing a Puritan would say. So the Puritans and the separatists believe the same things, but whereas the separatists, like the pilgrims, just want to be left alone, the Puritans were willing to get involved in everything because everything is under the Lordship of Christ. So you can see the distinct difference in why the pilgrims could be ignored, but the Puritans couldn't be ignored. In fact, they took over England and they executed the king. I mean, that's how seriously they took it. Now, some would say they went too far. And I would have thought it would have been, personally, I just think it would have been better if they exiled the king or anything else. I understand their principle that no one's outside the law and even a king is under the law. But I think they discredited their cause and they have earned a lot of animosity through the centuries from monarchists in particular. I mean, I've got a lot of monarchist friends who are aghast that I can admire Oliver Cromwell. I have a lot of sympathy for monarchies, constitutional monarchies, but I think Oliver Cromwell was a man of his time and a man ahead of his time who dealt with the issues with much courage and integrity. Any other comments?
One thing that reminded me of David with King Saul, when he had an opportunity to kill King Saul, he spared him and he never actually killed him. But
yes.
In this case, Charles wasn't spared, and I was thinking that might be a reason to spare him because David had spared Saul, and it seems like a godly thing to do. But then again, Saul was also God's anointed, and Charles was.
Exactly. It's not quite the same, but I like the principle. And I would have thought the trouble is if you overstep the mark at a certain point, you get yourself into the point where you're the guilty one now, even though you've reacted to a lot of atrocities. I think they would have been better off just exiling the king rather than going for execution. I can see why they did it. Knowing what I know now, I don't know if I would have disagreed with them at that time in that situation, but I would think they'd made the wrong decision. I think that unnecessarily discredited their cause over the centuries since. But that's all very well for us to speak here. We're not in the middle of the situation they were in. But still, from the best analysis from my side is, I think that was the wrong decision. But it was a principled decision, all the same. I think if they'd taken David's attitude of, I'm going to leave him to God. Well, leaving someone to God is very serious. God can execute his own justice.
No, I just wanted to say, I think, well, taking into consideration what all the atrocities you just listed that he did,
yes,
I think he was deserving of
yes.
the death penalty. As we saw, I don't know if there's any recollection of him actually... like,
not to that extent.
Yeah,
he did try to kill David.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But like peoples of his own, like his own people. So I think you said he killed people, he imprisoned them without trial.
Yes. Now, there's no doubt that Charles the First got what he deserved. I mean, there's no question about that. But sometimes it's a matter of just strategy too. So, for example, there's no doubt in my mind that every single baby killer deserves the death penalty. Abortionists are not real doctors, they're murderers. Whether it's Gosnell or first-term abortion people, they all are death penalty type things. But that doesn't mean because they deserve it that we should take the law into our own hands. That would discredit our cause, we pro-lifers. It would be better to enact laws which the whole population can agree with and have the court of law, due process of law, but that'll take time. But in the meantime, just saying they deserve to die and face justice. But if you cross that line, you take law into your own hands, you make them the victim. And there have been some cases of some pro-lifers getting up there and assassinating an abortionist. And what they do is they put the cause of the pro-lifers back. The pro-lifers put in the position of being the villain. And it helps camouflage the real villains, who are the abortionists. So to say that this king deserved to be put in trial and executed, there's no doubt about it. But I'm just saying strategically, it probably wasn't the best thing from a public relations point of view for the Puritans.
The trouble is that Charles never repented. And he was,
no.
If you had set him free somewhere, he would have started his trouble again.
He would have.
Because
and he would have organized a new army to invade England, yes.
He was going to stop.
Yes.
So I think they did the right thing. He got what he deserved. He was a murderer and a killer. And in terms of biblical justice, he got biblical justice. And people don't like it. It's tough luck.
The interesting thing is the Puritans had scriptures for everything. And they could take you all the way to Psalm 149. Executing the heads of nations and killing kings and putting kings under your feet, and this is the glory of the saints. And they had lots of good biblical warrant that there's prophecies about kings of the nations being put to death. But of course, those are messianic psalms, and it's one thing for the Messiah to do it when he returns. It's nothing for us to do it. But still, I don't doubt that Charles deserved it. I'm just saying it was a public relations disaster for the Puritans. The Puritans were on the ascendancy. They were taking over. From that point, they lost a lot of friends, like Richard Baxter, who's a Puritan, but he couldn't agree with regicide. That's the word they used. I still have some people thinking, do you approve of regicide? Do you support that? regicide dictator, Oliver Cromwell. And so obviously there's a very emotive concern. I don't like the idea of creating a martyr for the other side, even though there's no doubt he deserved it.